That's fine. So when you see representations of the Buddha with, a jewel or what it is, it's referred to as the third eye. Yeah, so it's basically... A lot of the representations you see have that. Alright, is this thing still? Yeah, it's still working. Good. Alright, welcome everyone. Welcome to session 5 of Buddhism in a Nutshell. So my name is Scott Miller, and I've been, Karen unfortunately is not feeling well. So she contacted me yesterday and asked me if I would substitute for her, which is what I'm doing. So I'm sorry that Karen won't be here, but I'm really glad to be here with y'all tonight. And I'll do my best to, you know, be a reasonable substitute. I'm not going to be a great substitute for Karen, but, you know, we do what we can. Is there anyone who is here for the first time? Anybody who's, okay, you guys are here. Welcome. Anybody who, are you here at Kadampa Center for the very first time, too? Okay, great. Well, you're kind of diving in right at the very end of this particular class. Buddhism in a Nutshell is an introduction to Buddhist philosophy, basically. And is this sound okay? Do you want me to switch to a different mic? How's that? I think this is working. Yeah. Okay. A little less staticky. Good. I've been coming here to Kadampa Center for about 10 years now, which is kind of hard to imagine, but about 10 years. And so mainly I cut the grass. I'm one of the volunteers who cuts the grass. That's like my main job here. But every once in a while, they'll let me lead a Buddhism in a Nutshell or Meditation 101 class. So just the really basic entry-level stuff. If you're here for the first time, so welcome. We're glad you guys are here. This is a very introductory class, but it is session 5 of the very introductory class. So quite a few people have been here and talking about different subjects, and so you all are diving right into the deep end, but that's great. We actually do quite a few different types of introductory classes here, so if you find any of this interesting and you want to come back for other things, and if you have any questions at the end, I'm happy to answer questions, too, if you want to get caught up on anything. One thing I really like, and I don't know if Karen was a stickler about this, but I kind of am, I like when people come up and sit closer to the front, because then it's not like we're, you know, kind of shouting across this big room. So you don't have to, like, there are no rules, and I'm not going to get upset if anybody doesn't. But if you feel like coming up and sitting a little closer, you know, if you want to be in the center, that's fine. But if you want to sit closer to the front, it just makes it seem a little more, I don't know, friendly, personal. Not like we're all in this huge auditorium all spread out and everything. And if you don't want to, if you want to hang out in the back, that's fine, too. But thank you for coming up closer. I think that's nice. All right. So as a reminder, if you have your cell phone with you, please turn it on meditate or silent or airplane mode or off or whatever you want to do so it doesn't make any noise while we're meditating or anything. For those who are here for the first time, we're pretty informal here. So, like, yeah, I guess Hedy probably told you where the restrooms are, right out and to the left. If you want to get up and visit the restroom or go out and get a cup of water or something like that, please feel free. Let's see. So let's start. It's always really nice to start these with a meditation. So I'm imagining those who've been here for a while know you've been practicing the 7-point meditation posture. If you haven't, anybody who's never meditated before, never done any meditation? Okay. Well, if you've done a little, then if you're sitting in a chair, basically if you're sitting in a chair, you just want to sit up straight. Try not to have your back against the back of the chair. If your feet don't rest on the ground, you can grab one of the cushions that's laying around. And feel free to get up and grab a cushion like the lady in the green shirt is, so you have a cushion underneath your feet. And just sit in a comfortable position. We won't get too deep into the specific meditation posture. The most important thing is that your back is straight. So it's really nice, a really nice analogy that I think works well is if you imagine you're like a marionette, you have a string at the top of your head, the crown of your head, lifting you up, not like rigid, stiff, where it's uncomfortable, but just lifting you up straight, just sitting up straight. So as you're sitting straight, take a moment and focus your attention on your breathing. And breathe naturally. We're not trying to breathe in any certain way. Just breathing naturally. Just observing the breath. Focusing the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. More observing the breath. And definitely not trying to breathe any certain way. Just watching your breath. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. Create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session. Motivation is very important. Doing things with intention, having a thought for the reason why you're doing things is a very important part of this practice. So you're going to think that you're meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. If that seems a little heavy right now, then just think that by being here and meditating, you're doing something good for yourself. You're doing something that's very beneficial. And maybe it will help you be of benefit to others as well. And focus your attention at the opening of the nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. Notice the air passing through your nostrils. You might notice the small hairs in your nostrils move. You might notice cooler sensations as you inhale, maybe warmer sensations as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Just place your attention on the sensations right at the opening of your nostrils. You're an observer, and you're keeping your attention placed on those sensations right at the tip of your nostrils. As you exhale and then inhale, mentally count each exhalation and inhalation together as one. So noticing yourself exhaling, noticing yourself inhaling, count one. Noticing yourself exhaling again, noticing yourself inhaling again, count two. And count from one to ten, concentrating on the sensations at the tip of your nostrils. And when you reach 10, begin again at 1. that distractions are perfectly normal. If you become distracted by a sound or by a thought, and your mind wanders away from your point of concentration at your nostrils, then gently, without any other discussion with yourself about it, bring your attention back to your breath and begin counting again at one. The point of the meditation is actually to train your mind to focus on one point, to focus on one thing. So when you find yourself being distracted and you bring your attention back to your breath, you're actually doing exactly what you should be doing in this meditation. Being able to concentrate for all the way to 10 is a great thing, but it takes practice and time. So take a moment now to dedicate any positive energy, any insights, any benefit that you received from practicing this meditation. Dedicate all of that to the well-being and happiness of all sentient beings, of all living beings. So take a moment, think about dedicating the merits, dedicating the positive energy from this practice to your well-being and the well-being of all beings, all sentient beings, all living beings. And gently bring your attention back to the room. How y'all doing in the back? Have you guys been here before? Is this your first time? Okay, welcome. So a few people who are here for the first time, and as I was saying a few minutes ago, this is a very basic beginner's class, but it is the fifth session of the beginner's class, so we're going to be talking about some things that people have been talking about for the last few weeks, but it's nothing, well, I'm going to say it's nothing too complicated, but we'll see. If you have questions later on about anything we talk about, I'm going to stick around for a little while after the end, and I'm happy to answer any questions. So welcome. We're glad everyone's here. what I'm interested in right now is hearing from you guys about what you've been discussing with Karen. So last 4 weeks, you've been talking about Buddhism and, you know, what it is and what it's all about. So what are some of the things that people have gotten from this course? Some of the maybe ideas, the concepts, what's Buddhism all about? Pretend I just walked in off the street, kind of like I just did, and you're going to tell me what Buddhism is all about. So what are some of the key ideas that you've taken away from this course so far?
Kind of, we've explored the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. They kind of go hand in hand, but we've also covered, I guess, the history of Buddha himself, so like the personal history. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably missing some things when it comes to the like different ideas of Buddhism that we've covered, but I know we've done a little bit on the Noble Truths and the Path, but that's all I can remember right now.
Okay. Somebody want to tell me what Buddhism's all about? Like, what are some of the key ideas in Buddhism? What are some of the key things that are involved? Yes, sir. Over there.
I think at its core, it's about compassion.
Okay. What's compassion? Can you tell me what compassion is?
Thinking of others as much as you think of yourself, maybe?
Thinking of others as much as you think of yourself. I think that's a pretty good working definition. So does anybody else have a definition for compassion and what compassion is and what it's about? Any other ideas? Yes, sir.
I'm pretty sure Google defines it as the wish to, or maybe not the wish, but it says something about like seeing someone else suffering and wishing to like alleviate it. So the, I guess, emotional desire to, I guess, prevent or stop either suffering or pain in someone else, something like that.
Okay. So, yeah, it's very interesting because Buddhism has some very specific definitions for terms that we tend to use rather ambiguously in everyday conversation. So, you know, if I say compassion, what's compassion? You might have some ideas about it, and you might have some ideas about it. And sometimes we have very general ideas about it, but Buddhism has some very specific definitions. So the Buddhist definition of, at least, and anything I say about Buddhism, by the way, is pretty much specific to Tibetan Buddhism in the Gelugpa tradition as it's practiced here, as I've learned from the people here. So I'll do my best to stick with that. But, you know, generally the definition that we use is the wish for someone to be free from suffering. That's the definition of compassion. And someone could be you. It doesn't have to be someone else. I mean, hopefully a lot of it will involve other people, but, you know, we say, like one of the prayers we say on Sunday mornings, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. That's everybody, including you. And we sometimes tend to leave ourselves out of that, but so that's what it is at its core, the wish for beings to be free from suffering, for someone to be free from suffering. What about love? Does anybody know a definition of love? Because we talk about love in Buddhism, too, or loving kindness. Does anybody know the Buddhist definition of love? It's very similar. The microphone's really helpful because we record these.
I don't want it to be wrong.
No, that's okay. Oh, man. What's the fun?
Stream from home.
Yeah, people listen. And what's the fun if you're right all the time? Anyway, that's such a boring, boring way to run a class is if people just give all the right answers. So what are you thinking? What's your thoughts?
Well, I kind of had it, so I wrote it down as loving/loving kindness, and I said, like, all sentient beings being happy and all sentient being free from suffering and having equality, which is equanimity, is which I wrote down.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You hit it. The wish to be happy. The wish for someone to be happy. That's love in the Buddhist definition. So It's very interesting because some of these things, when we talk about them or we experience them in everyday life, we talk about them in everyday conversation, they're kind of a lot of the things that we think of are a mix of different things, right? They're kind of like a bunch of different emotions mixed together. So a lot of times when we say we love someone, there's that wish for them to be happy. And then there's also a lot of selfish stuff too, like, you know, I want this person to love me back and I want this person to do this for me and that for me. And so really we get very specific in Buddhism about these definitions. And what's actually, out of all these things we feel when we're feeling love, what's the part that's actually love and what parts are other things, right? So the wish to be happy. What's the goal in Buddhism? What if somebody says they're a Buddhist, like what's their goal in being a Buddhist? What's the purpose of being a Buddhist? Yes. Oh, back there, yeah. We can get a few people's ideas.
To reach enlightenment.
Okay. Any other ideas, definitions? What were you going to say? Same thing?
I was going to say the same, but I guess at the same time, like, be free from suffering. Like, you know, I don't want to suffer.
Yeah. Okay. What is enlightenment? What's enlightenment?
I wasn't going to answer that, but I was also going to say if the goal for Buddhism is to, I guess, become unattached from the causes of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The tool to become unattached from the sources that cause suffering, at least from what I understand.
Okay. So what is it? Do we get to what enlightenment is? Do we answer that? What's enlightenment? Because it is a really important thing. That is the goal in Buddhism, is to become enlightened. And so there are different types, there are different, you know, versions of Buddhism too. There are some types of Buddhism that focus on like the individual path. So individual liberation from suffering, that's a very important, that is the goal in some types of Buddhism. What we practice is Mahayana Buddhism. And so the goal, the ultimate goal in Mahayana Buddhism is to become a Buddha, to become enlightened. And that's, you know, freedom from suffering is part of it, but when we talk about enlightenment, there are basically two parts of enlightenment. Yeah, what can you say? We're keeping Hetty busy tonight.
To help others reach enlightenment as well?
To help others reach enlightenment. Yeah, that's others. That's important. So a Buddha is someone, this Buddha is a Sanskrit term, and it has two syllables, Bu and Da. And the term in Tibetan is Sangye, which same thing, has the same two syllables. And it represents two things. It represents completely freeing your mind from the causes of suffering, from afflictive emotions, from afflictive thought patterns that in Buddhism we say are the cause of suffering. Right? And then the other part of it is to fully develop all the positive qualities of mind. What's a positive quality of mind? If I say positive quality of mind, what are you thinking of? Yeah.
Generosity.
Generosity. You get one. Pass the mic around. What about you, sir? What is your idea of a positive quality of mind? Go ahead.
Empathy.
Empathy? Okay, excellent. Let's get a few people with the Outer Banks shirt on, sir. What's a positive quality of mind?
Compassion.
Compassion. Sure. Excellent. Anybody else? Yeah.
Wisdom.
Wisdom. Yep. Okay. What do you think? What's a positive quality of mind? Can you think of one?
Joy.
Joy. Sure. Joy. Yeah. For some of these short answers, I'll just repeat what you say so everybody can hear it. So yeah, the idea, and this is kind of a radical idea, a couple radical ideas involved in this in Buddhism. One is that, so the Buddha, I'm sure Karen went over the story. The Buddha lived 2,500 years ago in India. He was a prince. He, you know, grew up in this very wealthy family. His father was basically a king, grew up in the palace. At some point he decided to go out and become a wandering holy man, basically. And he wanted to find the truth about suffering. He saw that, you know, in spite of this wonderful life that he lived, that everybody in the world basically suffered to some degree, including him, and he wanted to know why. He wanted to understand this. And what he discovered through a very intense practice of meditation and these very intense spiritual practices that he did was he became enlightened. He reached enlightenment. He reached a point where he had fully developed all positive qualities of mind, joy, compassion, empathy. Right, all the stuff that we know is good, when we're feeling it, it's, you know, a very positive feeling. And he fully and completely eliminated all negative qualities of mind. So greed, anger, jealousy, things like that. So a couple radical things that the Buddha said. One was that it's possible to do that. It is possible for anybody, any of us, according to, you know, again, this tradition, Mahayana Buddhism, it's possible for anyone to fully develop their mind to its full potential, to fully develop all the positive qualities of mind, all the stuff we'd like to have more of, and to completely eliminate all the negative qualities of mind, all the stuff that you know, drags us down. And another thing that he said that's related to that, that's kind of radical, is the idea that when we talk about suffering, the Buddhist view of suffering is, so things happen to us, right? You know, if I go home and, you know, go home tonight and my girlfriend, first thing she says to me is something really, you know, she's upset about something, so she snaps at me and gets really angry and, you know, tells me off as soon as I walk through the door. Okay, so that happened, right? We're not going to say that that didn't happen. But that is not what makes me suffer. It's my reaction to it that makes me suffer. It's me going, I was doing a really nice thing. I was teaching the class for Karen because she was sick, and now you're yelling at me first thing when I want, you know. So it's my reaction. It's the way that we react to things is the cause of our suffering. Those things do happen. This you know, gets involved with the Four Noble Truths. So all these negative things that happen to us that we would consider suffering do happen. But the real causes of suffering are the afflictive emotions in our mind, the negative thoughts. In fact, we talk about virtuous and non-virtuous thoughts, right? So virtuous thoughts are ones that are the causes of happiness, that lead to happiness. Non-virtuous thoughts are ones that lead to suffering. And that's how we view the mind in Buddhism. So I'm not going to rehash the whole class, but those are some really important points and some really important concepts. It's very interesting. If you ever read any of the Dalai Lama's books, he always starts out, or most of his books, I won't say most because I haven't read most of them, but most of the ones that I've read, he always starts by saying, somewhere in like the first few pages, he says, everyone wants to be happy and avoid suffering. We all do. Like every person on the planet right now, in one way or another, wants to be happy and wants to avoid suffering. And this is something we have in common right now at this moment with every human being on the planet. Every living being, even ants, little ant, will try to avoid things that are harmful and do more things that are beneficial. Right? And so that's really what the goal in Buddhism is, to be happy, to fully develop the mind that allows you to experience true happiness. What's happiness anyway? You talk about happiness. What is it? Yeah.
A chemical reaction?
Happiness is a chemical reaction. So if I mix the right chemicals and dump them into my brain, I'm going to be happy. Hedy, can you?
Well, like three chemicals, oxytocin, serotonin,
okay,
dopamine.
So what you're talking about is the brain. You're talking about what goes on in the brain. So really important, and so by like a medical or scientific definition, yeah, that would be like a lot of neuroscientists. If you were to go to Duke and talk to a couple neuroscientists there, they would probably agree with you 100%. So it's fantastic. In Buddhism, it's really helpful to remember that we talk about the mind and the brain as being two different things. So the brain is a physical organ in your body. But when we talk about mind, we're talking about another, like a synonymous term is consciousness, right? Consciousness. And one way to think about consciousness is like everything you're experiencing right now, this whole entire subjective experience you're having of being in a room and hearing sounds and seeing colors, that you're existing right now in this space, that's consciousness, like awareness, another term, okay? So what Buddhists would say is the brain is physical. The brain is a physical organ in your body, just like your hands, just like your heart, just like your liver. The mind is non-physical. Right? Your experience right now of being in this room and everything you're seeing and hearing is not a physical thing. Now, if you were to ask, you go to Duke and talk to like their chief neuroscientist. I don't know who that is, but I think we have some people here who are researchers at Duke, aren't we? Maybe one, I don't know. But so you would talk to one of these guys and say, what causes consciousness? They would say, oh, these chemical reactions in your brain. Right, so very common, in modern science to believe that the mind is the product of the brain. But if you were to say, okay, show me the study that proves that the activity in your brain causes this entire subjective experience of consciousness, they'd go, well, we haven't really, it's a theory. We haven't really proven that yet. Because we haven't, right? So what we say, when we say in Buddhism that mind and brain are two different things, it's not really contradicting modern science. Most scientists, in their own personal opinion, based on the evidence they've seen, would say, well, yeah, the brain produces the mind. But they haven't really, that hasn't been established. The causation, correlation does not prove causation. I teach logic for a living, so I like to get into the whole correlation versus causation thing. And just because two things happen at the same time doesn't mean one causes the other. So what the Buddhists say is that mind and brain are two separate things, and happiness occurs in the mind, not in the brain. I went off on a little tangent there, but that's like the whole point. Happiness is something we experience with our minds, right? And so anybody else have an idea of what happiness is? Yes, sir.
I kind of think of happiness as a contentment with my behavior and I guess emotional status and that sort of thing for more, like if I'm happy in a moment, I used to believe, oh, I'm happy because right now I'm happy, but these days, I test how long that'll stay with me, maybe a week, 2 weeks, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of it as, a kind of happiness as a developed behavioral pattern / attitude and mindset that is all interdependent that I guess you achieve good moments or
okay,
good
moments. Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, did you want to add something? Yep.
I see it from a different perspective as in Buddhism we strengthen the mind. And by strengthening the mind, then we can better deal with all the external things in life. Mm-hmm. And if you can strengthen it and deal with situations better, then it would make you more peaceful and more happy, and you can live a better life. And that's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important through meditation is to strengthen the mind so that we can live a much more peaceful and happy life.
Okay. What was your definition of happiness? You want to borrow here? Borrow my microphone. What's your definition of happiness?
Well, my comment wasn't my specific definition. So, when Geshe-la teaches about happiness, he just, mentions that we have to be responsible for our own happiness and our own suffering. And so, his example is his favorite chocolate chip cookie that he talks about at Whole Foods. And then when he goes to Tibet, he doesn't get the cookie. So he can't have all his happiness based on the cookie. He has to be responsible for his own happiness in his mind. So that's what I think of.
So yeah, that's a core concept in Buddhism is that we are the creators of our own happiness. We are responsible for it. We have to create that, absolutely. Yeah.
I think also probably part could be, I think I would be happy once I would fully understand the concept of emptiness.
Okay.
So
we're going to get there. That's a great introduction to one of the topics we're going to talk about tonight. So just to put a little exclamation point on it, the Buddhist definition of happiness, I guess, would be when you're fully experiencing and only experiencing. What do you think? Tell me if I get this right, Hetty. Fully experiencing and only experiencing those positive qualities of mind. and not experiencing any of the negative, any of these non-virtuous qualities of mind. That's happiness. And one of the things they say about happiness is completely congruent with reality. That's one of the qualities of happiness, is when you are truly happy, you are completely in alignment with reality. And so one of the ways we talk about suffering is it's delusional. It's delusional. I mean, think about it. Have you ever really lost your temper, really gotten like in a huge fight with somebody? And so, like, let's say, what's your name? Samantha. Samantha and I get in a fight over whatever, and we're sitting here screaming at each other, and I'm telling her what a terrible person she is and how terrible a thing she did is, and she's saying the same thing about me. How accurate are we really being? Like, how much is anything we're saying actually representative of anything? You know, not much, right? You exaggerate so much when you're in these, you know, greed, anger, jealousy. They're all exaggerated states of mind. They all exaggerate reality. And they're like, so one of the things that we say is a very interesting idea in Buddhism is that these negative emotions, these negative afflictive emotions are not actually part of the mind. So often we'll talk about them like the mind as pure water, pure clean water. And these afflictions that we experience are like pollution in the water or dirt in the water. So they're there, but they're not part of the mind itself, and they can be removed. And once you remove these afflictions, then what you have left over is the pure mind itself, which is in the nature of all these positive experiences, all these positive states of mind. And that when you have removed all these afflictions, you're no longer suffering from these delusional states of mind that distort reality, and so you're in alignment with reality. So good. So that's a little bit of, you know, there's Buddhism in a nutshell, right? A little bit of a review. There are a couple of specific topics that we want to talk about and that I at least want to briefly mention because they're pretty important. So one of the things that Karen told me was that she really didn't get too far into precious human rebirth and what that means. So I'm just going to give you the whirlwind tour of this. In Buddhism, because we say that the mind is non-physical, the mind is not your brain. The mind consciousness is a non-physical entity. And the idea here is that something physical cannot be the cause of something non-physical. So if consciousness, if mind is not physical, if it's not physical, it can't be caused by something physical. Something physical can only cause something else that's physical. So what, and this is maybe just kind of dipping your toes in it, but the idea is that each moment of consciousness that we experience is produced by a previous moment of consciousness, which is produced by a previous moment of consciousness, which is produced by a previous moment of consciousness. And this extends all the way back to birth, beyond conception. So the idea in Buddhism is that mind, consciousness, is infinite, goes back, there has no beginning. There is no first cause, no first, which is a really hard idea to wrap your head around because we think of everything. Everything we experience in everyday life has a beginning. But what they say in Buddhism is that the mind has no beginning, right? So this is the basis for the Buddhist idea of rebirth. And it just seems like a lot. Some of these ideas that we talk about, if they seem like really a lot to handle, it's just, this is one of the things that Geshe Gelug, our teacher, says a lot, and it's really important to realize when you're here, is he always says, this is for the sake of information. He says a lot of these small things that you kind of like don't maybe pay a lot of attention to until like the fifth or sixth time you hear him say it, but he always says on Sunday mornings and other times, he says, this is for the sake of information. And that's all that our teacher does here is he explains what he has learned and studied about Buddhism. Nothing that he says is about what we're supposed to do or what you should do or what you have to do. He's giving you the information about what the Buddha taught. And that's the way the Buddha taught, too. The Buddha never said, you have to do this because I'm the Buddha and you're not. And, you know, it was always, it's very much, a lot of the teachings of the Buddha are if-then. If you do this, this will be the result. If you want to achieve this, this is what you have to do to get there. So that's really the basis of Buddhism. So this idea in Buddhism, and this is based on, you know, the Buddha himself. The idea is when you clear all of these delusions from your mind, all the stuff that distracts us, the anger, the jealousy, the, you know, distractions, that the potential of the mind is amazing and that we have the ability to perceive things that, you know, as an everyday normal human being, I have no, you know, idea what this would be like. But apparently if you reach Buddhahood and you fully develop all the positive qualities of your mind, one of the things you're able to do is see this extension of the mind all the way back. And that's why the Buddha said, you know, that it has no beginning. Or I'm not sure if he actually said it has no beginning or something like, you know, he has never seen the beginning. So some of the things he said are a little bit, you know, kind of vague. But one of the things that this is the basis for the idea of rebirth. So the idea is that our minds, our consciousness, there's a core level of consciousness that, and it's not you, it's not like, well, so the idea is that your consciousness extends back and then you've lived previous lives, and that consciousness goes on after death, and that we will live future lives as well. So it's not like the idea of like you with all of your memories and your sense of humor and your emotions and your jokes and everything get reborn into a cow. You know, it's not like you're going to be a cow and remember when you were, you know, a person, and you're going to show up at the family reunion and say, hey, it's me, Moo. You know, it's the idea that there's a very subtle level of consciousness, a level of consciousness that we're not even aware of as normal human beings on an everyday basis. And that's what extends back and goes forward. So, again, take it as a theory. It's just, you know, for the sake of information. So one of the key ideas in Buddhism is that being born as a human being is incredibly, incredibly fortunate. That being born as a human being is just an incredibly wonderful thing. So what's so great about being human? Think of some of the advantages you have. And again, Buddhism's all about the mind, right? Everything in Buddhism is about developing your mind. So what makes being a human so great if your goal is to develop your mind? Yeah.
Because then we can reach enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Why? What makes being human so conducive to reaching enlightenment?
Well, the lower levels can't.
Okay, but why? I mean, just thought about, could you think of anything in your life that makes it rather, that makes it kind of easy for you in general to have a spiritual practice, to come here, you know, like to try to do what we're doing here? What do you think? What do we have as humans? What advantages do we have as humans that like a cat doesn't? Stuff we don't think about. We have cars. Yeah, it's easy. We don't have to walk here, right?
Yeah, yeah, like that. Like we can communicate with each other and like share the teachings.
Mm-hmm. We have abilities to communicate. Yeah. Yes, sir, in the back.
Like a higher level of knowledge, like a better understanding of how the world works.
A higher level of knowledge, a higher level of understanding, yeah. You know, like a lot of us, if you have pets, you look at your dog or your cat, you think, wow, it'd be great to be them. But really, animals' lives, as wonderful as we might think it is to be an animal, their lives are really driven by fear and instinct. You know, if you have a cat, you have your cute little fluffy house cat with the cute ears and everything and the fluffy hair, and you take the little feather thing and you wave it in front of them, they jump on it, right? You say, oh, that's so cute. What you're doing is triggering a predator instinct. Because cats, in their natural state, you know, wild cats have to kill something every day in order to live. And all the domestic cats, all the domestic animals that we keep in our house still have that instinct. So they're driven by these kind of not so great things. You know, think about why dogs like squeaky toys. I'm not going to go there. But, you know, they're really driven by these very, in some ways, very aggressive and violent instincts. And we're not. We have the ability to reflect on our minds. We have the ability to reflect on, you know, metacognition, think about our minds and think about why we do things and how we do things. And also what they say about human life is that we have a lot of leisure time. We have a lot of free time, a lot of, you know, the ability to communicate. We have cars. It's kind of, you know, especially the kind of life that we're born into in this country where we have good roads and we have, you know, listen to Geshe Gelug talk about what it's like to grow up in India. He grew up in India in a refugee camp, basically, a Tibetan refugee camp. So when you think, if you ever travel overseas and see some, like, places I love to visit, but when you see how some of the really poor people live in other parts of the world, it's you know, makes you really appreciate what we have. And so we have the ability to, not only do we have the ability, the mental ability to improve ourselves, but a precious human life is the kind of life where you also have the leisure time to do it, you know, and the ability to do it. So there are a lot of actually factors that go into not just a human life, but a precious human life. But we also experience suffering. And that's actually not a bad thing, because as humans, a part of a precious human life is that you experience enough suffering that you have the motivation to want to improve. You know, and they talk about different realms and different, like, you know, the idea, just like, you know, if you were to talk to an astrophysicist and say, you know, what do you think? Is there, you know, talk to, well, Carl Sagan's not around, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson and say, what do you think? Do you think there are, you know, beings on other planets? He would say, yeah, Totally. You know, just mathematically, it's very likely. So what Buddhism talks about is other realms of existence that we're not necessarily aware of. And there are realms that are like where all you do is experience pleasure. Anything you want. Oh, you know, I want an ice cream. Boom, it's there. But in those realms, they don't experience any suffering. So they, you know, live these wonderful lives, but that it's not really an opportunity to improve their minds any. And they're burning up a lot of, you know, very precious merit that got them there in the first place. But so, you know, to kind of distill this down, it's one of the things they do is, or one of the things some of our teachers say is, when you first wake up in the morning, be grateful. Try to, you talk about contentment. And even, you know, just feeling contentment or even going beyond that and feeling grateful. Taking a few moments first thing in the morning to say, wow, I'm alive. And I'm not living in Syria right now. And I'm not, you know, living under an overpass. You know, like, I have a pretty, I know I'm going to get at least one meal today, you know, or whatever. I have a car, I can get where I want to go. Because we do focus a lot on the negative. So just, you know, a lot of what we talk about in Buddhism, they're kind of like these higher goals, but a lot of it's very, very practical. Just take a moment to wake up in the morning and think, wow, I am so grateful for what I do have. Think about that first. Maybe a couple times during the day, try to remember that in the midst of all the chaos in school and, you know, the crazy coworker that you have to deal with and all that other stuff. So precious human rebirth is a pretty important point in Buddhism. The Buddhist view of death is also very interesting. So, and there, this is a whole huge topic we could spend a lot of time on, but just, you know, I think in the West, in our culture, we're really afraid of death. We're really afraid of dying. Most people are. They might not admit it, but we really are. And we see it as a very negative thing. So in a lot of Buddhist cultures and, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, they're not. It's not really seen as that bad of a thing. And there are kind of more advanced reasons for it with different types of practices. They say, you know, if you really are very serious and astute about meditating and you really develop your mind during your life, that at the time of death is when we have the ability to connect with this very subtle level of consciousness. And that if you practiced enough, that at the time of death you can actually connect with this, you know, this state of mind that's the core of enlightenment. So, you know, they kind of see it as an opportunity, or an opportunity you don't normally get during life. But there's a very simple meditation. If you want to try this, it's called the Simple Death Meditation, and it provides a pretty good feel for Buddhist views on death. So the way, I'm going to say it the way that Venerable Amy, one of the teachers that comes here and visits every once in a while, says it. She says, go home tonight, and on a post-it note, write the word death, and put it somewhere where you're going to see it first thing when you wake up tomorrow morning. Right, so you wake up, you think of this, and you see this, and look at that tomorrow morning and think, okay, I'm going to die this evening at 6 p.m. This is my last day of being alive. So don't worry, nobody's ever that we know of has ever actually died from doing this, but how would you live your day tomorrow? If you wake up tomorrow and you think, you kind of really take some time to think about, like, what would today be like if I knew this was going to be my last day on the planet? Would things bother you as much? The annoying coworker, the family member that gets on your nerves, the significant other that you've been arguing with, you know, is that stuff going to bother you as much? Are you going to spend as much time, you know, surfing Facebook or, you know, the stuff that we kind of like fill our time with that you always say, oh, wow, I just spent 2 hours doing that. Boy, I wish I'd done something else, you know. So it's very, you know, and it's a very interesting topic, but there is a very different view of death in Buddhism. On a very basic level, it's just kind of being constantly aware of it, constantly aware of impermanence. You know, we're not going to live forever. Nobody does. The number one, you know what the number one cause of death in this country is? Being born. Right? We're all going to, you know, it's going to happen to every one of us. So being aware of that, being a little more aware of that, changes a little bit the way that you live your life. You know, and realizing, you know, those two things, just realizing that this is really precious, this opportunity we have, this life that we have. Yeah, we've got problems. Yeah, we've got suffering. But, you know, overall, you could take a few moments every morning and be grateful for what you have, and then remember that it's not going to last very long. And just those two things. I mean, think about the effect that could have on your life if you remember to do those two things. So that's just kind of a very brief touch on the concept of precious human life and the Buddhist view of death, not as scary of a view as we have sometimes. Any questions? Right now, anything that everybody has on their mind? Yes? Do you want to, Hedy? Can you? The microphone's really helpful because I'm going to tell you, one of these days you're going to pick up some recording on our website or something like, oh, really, I want to listen to that class. And somebody's going to be asking a question. They're not going to use the mic, and you're going to be going, this is what you're going to hear. And you're listening to the recording going, what did they say? So just remember that when you're using the mic, that you're helping yourself in the future by doing that. What was your question?
So my question is just relating to how Buddhist traditions sort of acknowledge and sort of deal with death. Mm-hmm. Are there certain traditions or kind of practices that they, you know, employ to sort of recognize and deal with it in the way that we have funerals or mm-hmm. memorials?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain services. Interesting thing about Buddhism is, so Buddhism started in India. You know, Shakyamuni Buddha was born in India, and he taught in India. And then it spread out from India throughout, like, into Sri Lanka, into Vietnam, into China, Japan. It actually arrived back in Tibet fairly late. But an interesting thing about Buddhism is, as it spread, they kind of adopted a lot of the traditions of the cultures it spread to. So Tibet is a high plateau. You get grass, but not a lot of other pretty things grow there. It's kind of a very, you know, sparse landscape. So Tibetans like bright colors. That's why you see, like, a Tibetan altar is very brightly decorated. If you were to go to a Zen Buddhist center, Zen Buddhism is a Japanese tradition, and they're very into very austere, very simple, like, you know, Zen Buddhist art is like a single line on a page, you know. So it's just, and so you find a lot of the traditions, like, you know, in terms of funerals and stuff, do come from the individual culture that it's spread to. But in terms of practices, a lot of the Buddhist practice is designed to help yourself have the most positive state of mind as possible at the time of death. Because, you know, I know Karen probably talked about karma and how karma works. You know, we're all generating all these imprints in our minds, every action that we do, every thought that we have, every word that we say, every physical action that we do leaves an imprint on our mind that will affect us at some point in the future, in a future life. And one of the ways that karma affects us is it determines what your next rebirth is going to be like. But so we all carry around these karmic seeds, but also the seeds ripening, the karma actually affecting you, is based on causes and conditions. So if you have a very positive mind, a very peaceful mind at the time of death, that's going to help more positive seeds ripen so that you have a better future life. So some Buddhist meditations are specifically geared towards that, having a positive positive mind at the time of death. Yeah, Hedy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, there are specific meditations about death, and His Holiness does them at least every day, and I'm thinking it's something like 6 times a day He does the same meditation on death so that His mind is fully prepared when He dies.
Mm-hmm. And you have a question or a comment?
I was just thinking about population growth. So if we think, because, like, there have been things when, like, different species and then humans, like, the population's, like, ever increasing, apparently, mm-hmm. or whatever. But then if, like, deer population or whatever, their population's going up, where do those minds come from? Is it, like, humans being their minds being transferred? Or even if all the species are still increasing, where do those minds come from?
Sure. So there's the term sentient being that we use. So semchen is the Tibetan term. It means mind holder, mind possessor. So anything that is capable of intentional action is considered to have mind, to have consciousness. And so, you know, you can potentially, you have been all kinds of different things that have, the idea is, since mind is beginningless, since mind goes back to beginningless time, that you've been everything you could possibly imagine. Because there is no beginning to the mind, then it extends back far enough that you have literally been every type of person you could imagine. You and I have been brothers, sisters, aunt and uncle. We've been best friends, worst enemies. I've been your pet goldfish, you know. It's anything you could possibly imagine. If there's no beginning to mind, and we've had beginningless and countless rebirths, then, you know, all these different things are possible. But because, I mean, just think about species of insects. How many insects do you think there are just on this property right now? You know, maybe you don't like insects, but just, like, think this in a very analytic way. I mean, who knows, right? Millions. So when we talk about minds, insects possess mind. right? Fish possess mind. Birds possess mind. So the idea is, you know, a human rebirth is considered very rare and very valuable. You really have to work for it. The cause of a precious human rebirth is ethical behavior. So the more ethically you behave in every lifetime, the more likely you are to have another human rebirth. So the idea is, oh, you know, yeah, where are all these human minds coming from? Well, you know, humans are only a small, tiny fraction of the total number of beings on the planet, just on this planet. And if the idea is, you know, if you were to ask a Buddhist, oh, what do you think all those other planets out there are? Are there other beings on other planets? They would say, yeah, sure, probably. Just like Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? So we're not only dealing with minds on this planet, but, you know, you could end up, who knows, in your next life, you could end up some other planet somewhere on the other side of the universe, you know, as a goldfish. And I could be your partner goldfish in the same, you know, who knows, in the same bowl, right? But that's, so there's not limit. If you limit yourself to thinking just in terms of humans becoming other humans, then yeah, it gets a little weird. But really there's no, that limitation isn't part of the Buddhist philosophy. Okay? Yeah. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yes. I saw a photo of a Buddhist in Tibet when there was, you know, issues with China.
Mm-hmm.
He set himself on fire, like, as a form, like, you know, I guess suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was, like, I thought it was weird. You know, I don't know. Like, what's the thoughts on, like, you know, suicides and, like,
mm-hmm.
Buddhists?
So suicide is definitely discouraged very strongly because, you know, because human life is so precious and because if you end your life prematurely, you still have karma from that life that you have to experience. So it's better to live out your natural life and experience all the karma. So the situation in Tibet, you can, if you've studied this or if you know anything about it, if you don't, so basically, Tibet has been autonomous for very large portions of its history. At other times, it's been occupied by other countries around it. So in the 1950s, the Chinese Communist government invaded Tibet. They basically took over. It was an invasion. There was an uprising in 1959 where the ethnic Tibetan people tried to resist the Chinese occupation, and it went really badly. And so the Dalai Lama, who was the spiritual leader of Tibet, he kind of had to take on a political role when the Chinese invaded. He was still very young. He was like a teenager when the Chinese invaded. And he kind of had to become the spokesperson for, you know, more of a political role than the Dalai Lama had had. So after this uprising, they were really concerned that the Chinese were going to kill the Dalai Lama, and he had to escape in the middle of the night, basically, and go over the mountains, over the Himalayas into Nepal and then on to India. So since then, you know, the Chinese Communist government has treated the Tibetan people very badly. They're really second-class citizens in their own country. If you are an ethnic Tibetan in Tibet right now, it's going to be harder for you to get a job. It's going to be harder for you to get a loan. It's going to be harder for you to live than the ethnic Chinese who've moved there. It's also, there's, you know, I mean, the Chinese Communist government is not known for their human rights record, and they're especially harsh on the Tibetan people. So if we're in Tibet right now, it's illegal in Tibet to own a picture of the Dalai Lama because he's considered this radical, horrible separatist. The Chinese government paints him as a horrible person, even though all he ever does is work tirelessly for a peaceful solution to this conflict, and that's what he's done all his life. But they have, you know, they consider him an outlaw. It's illegal to own a picture of the Dalai Lama in Tibet. So if we're in Tibet right now and the Chinese police walked in and saw a picture of the Dalai Lama right there, we would all be arrested. I would be tortured because I'm the ringleader and they want to make an example of me, so I would be really horribly tortured for having that picture up there. And that's what life is like in Tibet. So, and things get better and then worse. So they did a few years ago hit a really low point, and there were some protests, you know, and monks were a lot of the people who were lighting, so people were lighting themselves on fire in Tibet because they didn't want to hurt other people. They don't want to get together and form a mob and start throwing rocks and burning down, you know, the police stations and killing people. So what Tibetan monks were doing and nuns to try to draw attention to how horrible the situation was in Tibet and how badly people were being treated is they would light themselves on fire. And, you know, it's a horrible form of protest, but that's what they were doing is trying to, it was a really, you know, to try to draw attention, international attention to the absolutely horrific conditions that ethnic Tibetans experience in Tibet. So that's the reason why they were doing it. And it's not something that would be considered, you know, a normally a good thing, but they were making that choice themselves to do that to themselves to try to draw attention to the situation that their people are experiencing. Okay. So I want to leave some time at the end for questions, but I want to cover, there's one topic we normally talk about in this class, and there's so much that we talk about, and sometimes we don't even have time, but you mentioned wisdom, emptiness, right? So emptiness is a really interesting topic in Tibetan Buddhism. And as far as I know, from talking to people who've studied different philosophies, it's kind of unique to Buddhist philosophy. This is one of the really unique, like meditation isn't unique to Buddhism. Shakyamuni Buddha, when he was, you know, living in India 2,500 years ago, he practiced meditation techniques that had already been practiced for like 2,000 years in India, right? And then a lot of other, you know, some of the general ideas that you encounter in Buddhism are based on other, you know, philosophies that were already in existence at the time. But emptiness is kind of a unique, is unique to Buddhism as far as what I've been told. And it's a really interesting topic. Some people say it's a really difficult topic, so we're not going to, in the next 15 minutes or even in the next half hour, really get a full understanding of it. But it's really, it's one of the main things we try to introduce in this last session, just so you've heard about it and so you can think about it and you know, study it a little more if you're interested. So it's an English word, right? Emptiness is an English word. But so you, one of the first things you have to do is set aside pre-existing ideas about the word emptiness, because it's kind of like the best translation we have for the concept. What it really is talking about is absence of inherent existence. When we talk about emptiness, what we're saying is things are empty of inherent existence. And what this has to do with is something that the Buddha observed when he was doing this very intense meditation on his mind and on the nature of existence. And it's something that he discovered and taught about. So, I mean, there are a couple different ways to explain it. So suppose I say the word ibu. Ibu. It's a funny sounding word, right? Ibu, I mean, who knows, sounds like a cartoon character or something, right? So maybe you have certain thoughts in your mind now that I say ibu, like you're thinking, oh, maybe it's an animal, maybe it's a color, you know, who knows, it's like a weird sound. Ibu, ibu, right? So what if I told you that in a certain dialect in Indonesia, a couple different languages that are spoken in Indonesia, ibu means mother? So what do you think about the word now? What is the word? What thoughts or emotions does the word ibu bring up now? Maybe you think of a woman in Indonesia holding a child and, you know, maybe positive. You know, we all have different thoughts about motherhood. So notice how your concept of that word shifted once I gave a meaning to it. Right? So this is what we mean by things not having inherent existence. So words, you know, we all think of words as having meanings, these words that we use every day, and the word just, that's what the word means, right? But if the word ibu, that word had an inherent meaning, then as soon as I said it, everyone would have known what I meant. Everyone would, oh, mother, yeah, in Indonesia, right? So just like words don't really have inherent existence, it's a sound, it's a vibration that my voice makes, that your ears pick up, that transfers to your brain, that your brain translates into this thing, right, this sound, this set of syllables. And then we ascribe meaning to that, right? So the Buddhist teaching on emptiness is we do that with everything. Right, and this gets really funky and really deep. I think it's kind of fun. Just kind of keep it fun, and it's maybe a little easier to think about. So the idea in Buddhism is that everything, every type of phenomena, everything we experience is actually empty of intrinsic existence. It doesn't mean that things don't exist. You know, when we start saying, oh yes, everything is empty, everybody thinks, oh, so the Buddhists say that nothing exists at all and everything's an illusion and it's all just we imagine all this. It's not what we're saying at all. Things do exist, right? This bottle with water in it does exist. If I hit it on my head, it's real. Yeah, that feeling that you're feeling is real. But all the characteristics that we ascribe to this, the thing itself doesn't possess. Right, they're not intrinsically part of this. So you have to think about this a few different ways, and that's why I bring my visual aid here. This is my assistant, Herb. Get it, Herb, plant, right? So am I pointing at the plant right now? I am, right? Does anybody think I'm not pointing at the plant? Yes. Why do you say I'm not pointing at the plant? Okay. What if I tell you that if I sight down my arm past my fingertip that what I see is the plant? Am I pointing at the plant?
Well, from I guess it has to do with where your perspective is. I could say he's pointing south.
Okay. Is there an object here that I'm calling a plant?
The table?
Yeah, there's a plant here, right? Oh, oh. So where I'm going with this, I mean, you're good. You're doing creative thinking, which is great. I'll kind of get to the shortcut and tell you where I'm going with this. I'm actually not pointing at the plant. I'm pointing at a part of the plant. I'm pointing at a stem on the plant, or maybe at a leaf. And actually, I'm not even really pointing at the leaf, because that leaf, I'm pointing at a very specific part of that leaf, which is made up of cells, right? And the cells, we could say, well, exactly the point on that cell that you're pointing at is whatever, mitochondria or whatever, right? So, you know, whatever kind of science you may have studied, you know, like every, you know, all the different parts of the cells, and then all those cells are made up of what are parts of cells made up of? Cell walls, like, so smaller parts of cells, which are made up of molecules, right, which are made up of atoms, which are made up of whatever, nuons and gluons and all that stuff, right? So anything that you talk about, you know, if I say I'm pointing at a plant, well, what is that plant? How does this plant actually exist? Well, we can say that the existence of this plant depends on the parts. If it weren't for all these different parts, there wouldn't be a plant here, would there? So you could say, okay, well, a plant is a collection of the parts, right? Now, when we said, but plant, the word plant is really a label that we place. When you look at that and you go, oh, look, there's a plant there. What it actually is a collection of parts that you have labeled plant, right? So, you know, when we talk about emptiness, when we say things are empty of inherent existence, we have to say, well, how do they exist, right? So when we say things don't exist independently, you know, separate and existing from their own side. We say they exist in dependence on their parts, right? Everything you experience exists depending on parts. This table here depends on the pieces of wood. This book depends on the pages and the ink. And so its existence is dependent on that. Another thing that things exist in dependence on is a labeling, we could say designating consciousness, labeling mind, right? So this, to me, exists as a plant right now. That depends on my mind labeling it a plant. If a little moth or grasshopper came hopping in here and hopped up on the table, the grasshopper wouldn't think plant. The grasshopper thinks lunch. You know, maybe it doesn't even have a concept of this being a plant the same way we do, right? It's going to say, oh, green thing that I eat, right? And it's going to eat it, right? So really the way anything exists is it's depending on our mind labeling it that thing. So you have this base, this object that's here, and it exists because it has parts. It exists as a plant because my mind labels it a plant. This exists as the color red because it's dependent on certain molecules that light bounces off of in a certain way that hit your eye, and then your eye says, oh, that's red, right? So everything that we experience exists in dependence on parts and on our mind labeling those parts a certain way. And the other thing, so there are three things that we say things depend on. The other thing is causes and conditions. So this plant exists in dependence on there being somebody planting a seed and that seed growing into this full plant, and then somebody putting a plant in a pot and sitting it out there on a desk and me going, oh, I need something for my example, for my emptiness example. So let me go, and I walked around out here and I found this one and I brought it in here and put it on the table, right? So this plant being here and us experiencing it a plant is in dependence on all of those causes and conditions that have created being here right now. Okay? So the idea is, and that's all that's there. There's nothing there that is not one of those things. When we look at this and we say it's a plant, there's nothing here that is not actually dependent on parts, on causes and conditions, or on your mind labeling it. That's not how we experience it, right? We experience things as having an inherent existence. So what's your favorite ice cream flavor? Do you like ice cream? What's your favorite flavor? Mint chocolate chip. Okay, I'm going to agree with you. I think mint chocolate chip is ice cream. Mint chocolate chip ice cream is excellent, right? Outstanding. Now let's say, what's your name, sir? Shepherd. Let's say Shepherd goes, oh, that is so disgusting. What do you and I immediately think? What's wrong with him? Right? So when we taste the mint chocolate chip ice cream, you and I experience it as being deliciousness. And what we experience on a very fundamental level in our mind is that the deliciousness is coming from that ice cream, that it is delicious. And if anybody doesn't agree with us, it's because they're wrong. Right? It's not because they experience it. They literally experience it in a different way than we do. Right? Now, the ice cream is still there. The mints are still there. The chocolate chips are still there. All the parts are still there. But Shepherd's mind labels those parts in a different way than ours do. We go, oh, delicious. And he goes, eh. You know, I like sushi, and there are things that I will eat that people would walk around if it was on a table. Like, they wouldn't get within 10 feet of it. You know, I don't know if you guys have had, what do I like that people, sea urchin, uni is uni. And anyway, there are things that I really like, types of sushi that I like that I know people would be like, whoa, no way. I think it's delicious. You wouldn't want to get within 5 feet of it. So am I crazy? People would say, yeah, how could you eat that? There's something wrong with you, right? But my experience of that thing, the way my mind labels those parts, is different from the way your mind labels it. Okay, but that's not the way we... And it's, you know, what do you guys think of this? Can you kind of wrap your head around it a little bit, you know? So it's not really hard to get, like, an intellectual understanding of this. You know, oh, yeah, Ebu, you know, you said that, it just sounded like a silly word. But then when you told me what it means, oh, now it has a different meaning. My mind labels it differently. And I understand that word, or it's just sounds that your voice is making, right? So we can intellectually understand this. The trick is, it's not at all how we experience things. We experience things as having, as existing from their own side. I experience you, everything that I experience when I see you, how you look and everything, to me is coming from you and has nothing to do with parts. It has nothing to do with, you know, my mind labeling anything. That's how you are, you know? If I happen to not like Shepherd, him and I have been, you know, bitter enemies for years, I'm going to experience him as just not a very good person. And it's not because I see him that way. It's because that's the way he is, right? And the thing we do this with most, maybe not the most, but one of the main and interesting things about Buddhism is that they say the thing we do this with ourselves, too. So one of the main goals in Buddhism is to understand how you really exist in this way, how the self, the concept of a self. So, you know, what is the self? You know, if I say, so, you know, I have this idea that there's an inherent me here, that there's an inherent Scott here, that something that this possesses has an inherent Scottness, right? Well, what is that? How do I exist here? Well, I have a body, right? And so my body is parts, right? It's muscles and organs and skeleton, blood, and everything. So they're a part, and those are made up of cells, and the cells are made up of cell walls, and that's made up of molecules, right? So what you have here is a collection of parts. And deeper you go, the more you just see smaller and smaller parts. So I exist based on causes and conditions, right? Somewhere back a long time ago, two people met, and they had a little gleam in their eye, and then 9 months later, I came along, right? And you know, everything that led up to me being here right now in this particular state in Raleigh, North Carolina, sitting in this room talking to you guys. And then there's a labeling, a designating consciousness, right? So my mind labels this entire collection of the physical body and the thoughts that I have as a self. But where is the self, right? Where is this thing that I experience as myself? Is it part of my body? I mean, what happens if I, you know, get my arm chopped off? Does that mean that, like, part of myself is gone? I would say, no, my part of my body is gone, right? Even just when I say, so my hand, my foot, my head, how many things did I just name? Three? What's that? What did you say? Way more. Well, so my hand, my head, my foot, how many things did I just name? Three. Four. Hand, foot, head, my. right? So we don't think of self as part of the body. We think of self as possessing the body. So where does it exist? Is it in your, is it your mind? Is the self your mind? Okay. Where in your mind, what part of your mind is yourself? Okay. My consciousness? No, because I would say my consciousness, my awareness. There's still two things that I just mentioned there. Consciousness and my, or awareness and my. So even, you know, no matter what you look at, you say, well, yeah, it's myself is my thoughts, but then you say my thoughts. So we have this idea that there's a separate me, right? A separate my. And so a really fun way of thinking about this. I think this is Venerable Rubina. She's a teacher that comes here a lot, usually like once a year. And she has some really fun ways of explaining things. And I think this may be hers. It's either hers or maybe Venerable Amy. No, this is probably Venerable Rubina. So what she says is, you know, imagine that all of your thoughts are like roommates living in a house. So you've got the relaxed roommate, you've got the angry roommate, you've got the jealous roommate, you've got the hardworking roommate. Like, these are all our thoughts in our mind that are running around, right? So yeah, that's the way the mind exists. We have all these independent thoughts. The thing is, we think that there's a landlord. We think that there's a self somehow controlling the whole thing or separate from those thoughts, and there isn't. Because the idea of self, when I say the idea self, me, mine, a self, that's just a thought. So that's just, you know, it's not something separate. It gets really juicy, right? The more, and there are some meditations that we do where you really, you know, you kind of carefully go through and you say, so is this concept of self that I have, is it my body? And then you think about, well, if it was body, if self was the same as body, then, and it's very interesting because a lot of Buddhism is based on logic. It's systems of logic, very strict systems of logic. So some of the meditations that you go through, we call them analytical meditations. You're actually doing a very careful analysis of a concept that you have, and the meditations are very careful systems of logic that explore that concept to see if your view of it is accurate. So, you know, there's some interesting meditations we do on emptiness where you go, is it my body? Well, if it was the same as my body, then this would happen, and that doesn't make sense. If self was different from the body, then that doesn't make sense either. So is it the mind? Well, if self is the same as the mind, then we would have this problem. That doesn't make sense. If self is different from the mind, then we would have this other problem. And the end result is you go, well, then the self is just, you know, I can't find it. And you spend some time thinking about that. And the idea is, so to kind of put the because we could spend, you know, literally like somebody like, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's the leader of our, you know, the organization, the FPMT, the organization that the center belongs to, he'll tell you, like, we could spend a month or a year talking about emptiness. We could come here every night for a year and talk about emptiness, and you would just start getting an idea of it. So don't think that, you know, these topics that I'm throwing out here for you to think about a little bit are going to all of a sudden click and make sense. You're, oh, yeah, I get it. But it's interesting to think about. And part of the reason this is so important, you know, getting back to Buddhism, is because the core, the root of our suffering, when you boil all of our suffering down to the very, very foundation of it, the root of our suffering is the belief in an inherent independent self. And so a lot of these, that's what drives a lot of these negative emotions, you know. One of the ways that somebody, you know, explains this is, think for a moment about how you feel when somebody accuses you of something that you didn't do. You know, you stole my phone. Where's my phone? I know you stole it. You know, it's a really frustrating feeling when somebody does that. You tend to have a very negative reaction to it, right? You want to go smack the person. So it's that really deep, kind of icky feeling that is driven by a belief in an independent self. It's they're attacking me, they're attacking myself. And a lot of these negative emotions that we have are really trying to protect that concept of self that doesn't even really exist. That's just a construct. You know, the idea in Buddhism is that there is no independent, inherent, existing on its own self. Every idea that we have about self is parts, causes and conditions, or the mind just labeling something, a thought that labels something as self. But it's the belief in this self, this inherent independent existence of ourselves, that's the root of all our suffering. And so one of the reasons why they study emptiness so intently in Buddhism is because they say, supposedly they say, that when you get a realization of emptiness, right, when you actually experience it, not just like conceptually, intellectually, okay, I get it, I know it's been taught about it, and I understand intellectually what it is, but when you really get a realization of it, so a actual experience of it as a phenomena, that's what cuts the root of suffering, that understanding, actually realizing emptiness and experiencing it as an actual phenomena, being able to experience phenomena as being empty of inherent existence and dependent on all those things. When you experience that, then you're all the roots of suffering are cut at the very root. And that's liberation. That's what we're going for. When we talk about being liberated from suffering, that's the idea, is that you can do that. So it's pretty beefy stuff. It's fun to think about, but it takes a long time. I mean, there are people who, monks who will say that they've spent their entire life meditating on this just to try to get a little bit better understanding of it. And if it's somebody who's a Buddhist and believes in rebirth, then, they'll say you'll spend lifetimes and lifetimes, trying to get this understanding, this real understanding of what this is. But if you can, and when you can do that, then that's when you experience liberation from suffering. So that's a little, kind of a whirlwind tour, but it's a really interesting topic, and there are some great books on it that have been written by different, Buddhist, even, modern, some books that have been written in the last 20 years or so by Buddhist scholars and monks and teachers that talk about emptiness and do it in a pretty accessible way. So right now, does anyone have any questions in the last, few minutes? Yeah.
So could you use, I guess, what you were explaining about emptiness to kind of reanalyze the, relationship one has with objects in a daily life and objects being sources of fulfillment and stuff like that, and kind of try to, use any kind of interpretation of emptiness to, kind of find the value of objects as objects without putting, because I guess I see in the modern world as a heavy dependence on objects and just things and constant fixation on either objects or concepts or sounds or anything.
Pleasure.
And so I've been trying to really use those things for their intended purpose and get the, real function of those objects. But it was kind of, I'm trying to think of how I could apply that to a day-to-day basis for, any person or any kind of.
Sure. So yeah, I'll say my windsurfer. I was out windsurfing in Jordan Lake today, and I really like my windsurfer. I got a new windsurfer a couple months ago, and it's really great. And but it's impermanent. It's going to get old. It's going to wear out. It's going to break and disintegrate someday. So if I get attached to the idea that I'm always going to have that thing and it's always going to be there to make me happy, I'm going to suffer greatly because that's not the truth, right? So yeah, spending a little time thinking about it. Well, how does this thing actually exist? Okay, it exists, it depends on its parts. It actually exists as a collection of parts. That is an inherent part. It exists independent on that. It exists on causes and conditions. If a chipmunk walked up, it would be some kind of big obstacle that it has to crawl over. An ant, it would be it's not a windsurfer. So it's part of it. It exists based on my labeling it, this wonderful thing that I go out and play with. And then, causes and conditions. Somebody came up with the idea and invented windsurfing, and somebody designed this particular one, and people built it, and people, collected all the, materials that it was made out of, and then I decided I want one, and I bought it. So, and then, what else is there besides those three things? What else is there besides my wonderful MacBook here? So there are parts, it's made up of parts, It's made up of my mind labeling it this particular thing and me perceiving it as this thing, and then all the causes and conditions that created it and cause it to be here right now. So what is here besides those three things? It's a great exercise to do to loosen up your mind. I love this, my beautiful computer that's going to be here forever and make me happy for all eternity. Because that you suffer a lot because of that. Yeah. So any other questions? Do you have a question, sir?
In terms of happiness, and we were talking about outside forces like you stole my phone, how does a Buddhist maintain happiness when there are those outside negative forces?
So a lot of it's practice. A lot of the like everything that you see here is really, you know, all the symbolism and everything, it's all intended to improve your ability to develop positive states of mind, develop virtuous states of mind. And a lot of it is just analysis. You know, you analyze your negative states of mind and you think, are they really productive? I mean, this is one way to do it. There are a lot of different ways to do it and a lot of specific practices that are designed to help you do exactly that. But one way is just to analyze it, like how useful is it to get, if somebody accuses me of something that I didn't do, is it really useful for me to get angry at them and yell at them or whatever? Is it useful for me to get angry at them and not yell at them and just be angry at them without saying anything about it? You know, how useful is anger in actually resolving that situation? When I'm driving home on 40 and somebody cuts me off and cuts in front of me, and I learned to drive in New Jersey, so I have some great hand gestures and verbiage that I use in that particular situation. But how useful is that? Is that person even seeing me? Right? I'm going to sit here and fume and fuss for 5 minutes and say all kinds of nasty things about that person. Has that affected them at all? No. Did they even do it? I mean, maybe they didn't do it on purpose, right? You know? So you start thinking about your reactions to things and just thinking about your reactions to things and think, do I have to react that way? Is it helping me to react that way? Or, you know, is there a more, if I practice being calm in these easy, like somebody cut you off on the highway, is it really that, you know, nobody got in an accident, you reacted, you didn't hit them, they didn't hit you, so is it really worth getting that upset about? And just try to practice a little bit, you know, maybe you start by trying to calm down faster. Maybe you start by afterwards remembering, oh yeah, I shouldn't have gotten upset in that situation, or I didn't have to get upset in that situation. And then maybe next time, while you're getting upset, you remember and go, okay, let me take a breath and calm down. And then maybe with enough practice, you eventually get to a point where when it happens, you remember and you don't even get upset to begin with. So it's practice a little bit at a time. And practicing in small situations eventually helps you in bigger situations, you know, because maybe there are things that are more difficult in life to deal with than somebody cutting you off on 40. And by practicing in situations where it's a little bit easier to control your response, you're actually learning to be able to gradually control your responses in more difficult situations. But there are a lot of specific ways to do that. What other questions? We have time, I think, for one more question before we, you know, officially close. And like I said, I'll stick around for a few minutes after if anybody has any. Yes, you have a question.
I have just a general question. Just curious as to where is the Dalai Lama now? Where does he reside?
So the official residence of the Dalai Lama is in Dharamsala, India. When the Dalai Lama first escaped from Tibet, that's basically where he ended up. The Indian government created a safe zone for the Tibetan refugees to come to. Basically, Dharamsala became the Tibetan capital in exile, the capital of the Tibetan government in exile. So there's actually a Tibetan, I don't know if it's a parliament, if that's exactly what they call it, but there is actually a Tibetan government offices and set up in Dharamsala, India. So that's the official seat of the Tibetan government in exile, and a lot of Tibetans live there, and that's where the Dalai Lama has his residence. He travels a lot, though. He travels all the time teaching. Okay, so I want to do a couple things, just a couple housekeeping things, and then we will wrap it up. But if you're interested in this, if you've enjoyed these sessions, even with me being here for the last one, and you want to continue on and do more, so the different opportunities that we have here at Kadampa Center. The next thing that we're starting, if you haven't done it yet, is Meditation 101. I don't know if they're doing anything in between. I don't think they are. I think the next thing is Meditation 101, which starts on May 15th. May 2nd. It is May 2nd. Yes, thank you for reminding me. And I know that because Donna asked me to lead it. So I'll be leading a Meditation 101 class, which is basically focused more on meditation. Instead of talking so much about the different aspects of Buddhist philosophy, we focus more on meditation. It's really fun. We do Discovering Buddhism, which is a 2-year ongoing series of, so each Discovering Buddhism module is 5 classes like this one. But what they do is where in all 5 classes in Buddhism in a nutshell, we try to give you a tour of overall general view of Buddhist philosophy. What they do in Discovering Buddhism is they'll talk about one topic. So they'll spend 5 weeks talking about meditation. They'll spend 5 weeks talking about karma and rebirth. They'll spend 5 weeks talking about emptiness. And so it's the same kind of topics that we cover in Buddhism in a nutshell, but covered in much more detail, you know, over a longer period of time. And it's great if you can start at the beginning, but it's totally fine if you want to jump in the middle. It's kind of nice if you can start if you, you know, and you can look on the calendar and see when they're starting a new 5-week module, and then you can go at any time, but if you're able to start at the beginning of a module, that's a nice time to jump in. And then we just kind of repeat those on an ongoing basis, so even if you're coming into it somewhere in the middle, you can, you know, pick up the modules that you missed when it circles around again. Sunday morning teachings are great. Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, he's a Tibetan monk. He comes and will teach on a variety of different topics. He's really, and he relates things. I mean, a lot of people won't realize Geshe, he's really fun. He's really funny. He laughs a lot. He's funny to listen to. He's a highly accomplished Buddhist scholar. I mean, the Geshe degree that he has, it's an academic degree. It's equivalent to a PhD in Buddhist philosophy. And I would say based on, you know, knowing people who have PhDs and knowing what it takes to get a Geshe degree, I would say getting a Geshe degree is at least as difficult, if not more difficult, and academically rigorous than getting a PhD in a, you know, Western university. So he's an expert in Buddhist philosophy. He's an expert Buddhist scholar. And he comes and teaches on different topics and in a very accessible way to, you know, how it affects our everyday life and, you know, going into Whole Foods and really wanting the cookies, but you know things like that. So Sunday teachings, we do a little bit more, like we'll say some prayers, we do some different things that are a little more like, you know, Buddhist ritual, not a lot, a little at the beginning and the end. We do some meditation, so anybody can come in on Sunday. It's very accessible. There are only a couple things we do, like Wednesday night classes and Friday night classes, that are a little more intense. It's not that you can't just show up and, you know, anybody can come and sit in the back and listen, but we are going to be doing more, like we do more like prayers in Tibetan, and, you know, you're going to be looking around and everybody knows this prayer in Tibetan, and you're going, wow, when they learn that, you know, just practicing. And we talk about more intense topics. So honestly, the thing about Wednesdays and Fridays is if you haven't been studying Buddhism for a while, it might be a little boring, but you can go check it out if you want. So those are some things that we do. That the next step, I would say, is if you haven't done the Meditation 101 class, come to that if you're interested in meditation. We talk a little bit about the Buddhist, you know, philosophy, but mainly it's focused on meditation. Discovering Buddhism is a great, you know, way to get more detailed information. And so, yeah, all those things are on the calendar. If you have any questions about any of those, I'm happy to answer them. The other thing I want to mention is, what we always try to mention at the end of this, is that so everything we do here is by donation basis. We don't get any money from any outside organization to run this place. Everything is paid for by donations. Most of the people here are volunteers. I think we have, like, what, 2 or 3 people that are actually paid staff, and everybody else is a volunteer. I'm a volunteer. Just about anybody you see doing anything here is a volunteer. So we do ask, all the classes we offer are for free, but if you'd like to make a donation, we have donation boxes right outside the door, and I think one near the front, too. If you'd like to make a donation, that's always welcome. It helps us keep the lights on and pay the mortgage and everything. Well, you can also donate through our website if you don't have cash with you. You can flip on your phone and go to the website and donate there. Also, if you're interested, if you've been hanging out here a lot or on a regular basis or think you might be and you're interested in volunteering, we have a lot of great volunteer opportunities, so you can check with me about that. I'll even put my email address up here on the board, so if you are interested in volunteering, you can shoot me an email and I can help you get in touch with the right person. But so yeah, that's all I have to say about that. What I'd like to do is, you know, I'm sure Karen's talked to you a little bit about setting a motivation and then dedicating at the end. So if we all just take a moment to sit and think and give yourself credit, right? There are a lot of other things that you could have been doing tonight, whether it's you just came tonight or whether you've been coming for all 5 sessions. It's very, you know, it's really good that you did this. And for whatever reason you did it, maybe you're just curious. You know, maybe you're not really interested in becoming a Buddhist, but you were curious about it. So you just came here for 5 nights, for 5 weeks to just learn something about it. Or maybe you're interested in developing your mind and becoming a better person, and becoming a less fearful person, a less jealous person, a less angry person, and developing the positive qualities of mind, like love and compassion and generosity and empathy. Maybe that's why you came here, because you thought this might help with that. So whatever reason that you had for coming here, think about that and give yourself credit. And realize that you did something very beneficial by coming here for these 5 sessions, or coming here tonight if this is your first night. And think that you know, really, really think very deeply that you're doing this, that you're benefiting yourself by doing this, and that you're also better able to benefit others. And try to really expand that dedication out, and really try and have a very sincere wish that all of the thoughts you've had, all the positive energy you've had, all the merit that you've developed by being here in this class, try to focus that and have a very sincere wish that it will help you be of benefit to all sentient beings. Think about all living beings, all humans, all animals, insects, all beings that we know about here on this planet, all beings that we haven't encountered yet anywhere in the universe, anywhere in any type of existence. Think that by improving your mind, you're part of the world, you're part of this universe, and by doing anything to improve yourself, you are benefiting all. And imagine that the train is picking up all this positive energy and carrying it out down the tracks to all other places that we're not going to reach tonight. All right. And have a good night. Thank you for coming. And maybe we'll see you here for Meditation 101 or for something else. And like I said, I'll stick around for a couple minutes. And if anybody has any questions, I am happy to answer them. Otherwise, we'll see you around.